It is always fun to be back here in Seattle and to specifically be at Timberlake Church. So believe it or not, to me, it's a massive vacation. It's a massive break from Wisconsin weather. And this winter has been especially horrible. I'm sure you've seen it on the news. We've actually, true story, canceled school 5 different times, not because of snow. We've canceled because of snow as well, but because it was so cold out. And we only cancel when it's 30 below or farther. Yeah, it's horrific. It is horrific. So this is tropical paradise to me. This is awesome. I am enjoying it. I'm just going to start a little differently than I typically do. I'm going to start today by letting you know right up front what my goal is, kind of where I'm going to bring you. If you've heard me speak before, a lot of times you're probably wondering, where is he going with this? And at the end, oh, there's where. Okay. I'm going to just let you know right up front what my goal is. It's very, very simple. Here it is. My goal is to convince you, in whatever way I possibly can, it is to convince you to start making room in your life and space in your life for God like never before. I'm not talking about on a Saturday evening or a Sunday morning. I'm talking about on a regular basis, carving out room for you to refuel your soul in some way. So that's the goal. That's where I'm leading you. That's what I'm hoping in whatever way I can to convince you. If it means I have to take off my shirt, I'm going to take off my shirt. I'm going to convince you. Dave, that's not going to convince us of anything. All right. One of the great Jewish prophets, a guy by the name of Jeremiah, took some time to write on an ancient manuscript, and the words that he wrote ended up becoming part of our Bible in the book of Lamentations. Here's what he wrote. He says this: "The Lord is good to those who depend on him, to those who search for him. So it is good to wait quietly for salvation from the Lord." Do you believe that? Do you believe that it is good for those who depend on the Lord, to those who search for him, to those who wait quietly on him? Do you believe that's a good thing? Now, most of us have at least heard of the show on A&E. It's a TV documentary show. I believe right now all they do is run reruns, no new episodes. But have any of you ever actually watched the show Hoarders on A&E? Yeah, that's disturbing. Right? And in some ways, it's really sad because you know there's some mental illness behind some of the crazy stories that unfold, the people who just accumulate and accumulate and accumulate and they can't get rid of anything. Well, I don't know if you realize this, but the first real case of hoarding actually was discovered, at least that we know about, was discovered in March of 1947. What happened is an anonymous phone call was placed to the New York City Police Department about this 3-story house in Harlem. In which the caller said there is a horrific odor coming from this home. And so police arrived at the house, and they knock, nobody answers, and so they decide, well, they're going to knock down the front door, right? They're going to try to just knock it down. Well, they don't knock it down because behind the front door is all this stuff that you see on the left side of the screen, just a massive amount of stuff. And so they're kind of stuck, and they decide, okay, we're going to go get a ladder, and we're going to climb into the second story of this house. And sure enough, that's what they ended up doing. And what they discovered behind that window once they broke in and got into the house was years and years and years of hoarding. Just some of the most bizarre items that you can think of. And so after 2 hours of searching through this house, they finally come across the body of one of the brothers. The home was owned by 2 brothers, eccentric individuals. Homer was the first one they discovered. He was hunched over in a chair, completely dead. They started looking for his brother, couldn't find him. And so what they had to do was they had to hire professional crews to come in and remove the stuff in the house. And over the next week and a half, they ended up removing 25,000 books, human organs that had been pickled in a jar, 8 live cats. Why do cats always appear on these hoarding episodes, right? A horse's jawbone, an x-ray machine, a Ford Model T, 14 pianos, and 130 tons of waste. So after a week and a half, after the cleaning began, one of the workers actually came across the second body, the body of Langley, the other brother. And so here they come across the body. The crazy thing when they found Langley's body is he was only 10 feet away from his brother Homer, but he was buried under so much stuff that they didn't even realize he was there. Now, I share that story for a couple reasons. Number one, to make you feel better about what your house looks like, regardless of what it looks like, right? You know, none of us have homes that look like that. Maybe your kid's bedroom looks like that, but your home doesn't look like that. But unfortunately, if we're honest, and if we were to kind of be forced to tell the truth, a lot of our lives look like that. A lot of our schedules look like that. A lot of our to-do lists look like that. A lot of our budgets look like that. A lot of our relationships look like that. There's so much packed in that it's almost impossible to really live. Which leads to the question, then why do we do it? And I think part of the reason is because we're Americans. And we like to live life to the extreme. We like to see what the human body is capable of. Certainly humans around the world are like this, but there's something about us as Americans. We just like to see how far can we push ourselves, which is why one of the best-selling books in the history of the world has always been the Guinness Book of World Records ever since they started creating it. We like to see how long can someone hold their breath? How long can someone go without sleeping? The record holder went 11 days. Guinness doesn't even allow that record to be done anymore because of how dangerous it is. You know, how far could someone fall? The record for that is 33,000 feet out of the air. Was in an airplane that blew up. They landed at just the right angle. We're in a calm, but just crazy stuff. Those are things that just test the capacity of the human race. And then, of course, you have the crazy, weird things like the world's longest nose, right? Or the world's widest mouth, or the world's stretchiest skin, just disgusting, right? The human body is absolutely amazing. We have so many different capacities. But here is the thing that I want to discuss for a little bit. Here's the thing I want to talk about. Here's the reality we have to live with, and that is this. Regardless of how many capabilities we have and talents, everybody has limits. You have limits, and I have limits. It doesn't matter how many talents you have. You may have 25 times the amount of talents I have. You still have limits. Doesn't matter how much energy you have. You get around certain people and you're like, where do you get all your energy? I have an 8-year-old boy who makes me seem calm. Where do they get that? It doesn't matter how much energy. It doesn't matter how few hours of sleep you need each and every night. Doesn't matter. At the end of the day, you still have limits. The fuel runs out. Now, out of curiosity, how many of you have ever in your driving years run out of gas? All right, I know not everybody has, but okay, about a third of us. A third of us have run out of fuel. I have run out of fuel one time in my life. It was in 1995 in one of our notorious snowstorms in Wisconsin. We get these all the time. The interesting thing is when I ran out of gas, I happened to be driving a car that I loved during that season of my life. Some of you may remember this, a Yugo. Anybody remember the Yugo? These things were classic, all right? Absolutely classic. And the cool thing about the Yugo is they got amazing gas mileage. And as a college student, that's all I cared about. How many miles can I get per gallon? And so even though I had this car that got amazing gas mileage, I still ran out of gas on the interstate in a snowstorm because the car still had limits. And it doesn't matter how much energy you have, how much you can do in your schedule, how much you're able to pack into your day, how many things on your to-do list you can get done, how creative you can be with your budget. At the end of the day, what you have to discover about yourself and what I have to discover is we still have limits. And if we do not discover our limits and if we do not embrace the fact that we have limits, here's what's going to happen. We're going to hurt ourselves and we're going to hurt the people in our life that we love. It's going to happen. Because in our pursuits of accomplishing and accumulating and getting the most out of life, we're going to end up losing control of our life. And unintentionally, nobody's going to do it on purpose. We're going to end up trading peace for progress. Which is why so many successful people will admit, hey, I've got it all and I've got this great life that I've built, but I still lack some sort of peace. I traded all to have a relationship with my kids. I traded all to get my marriage back. I traded all to... And you fill in the blank. And so, thousands of years ago, Solomon, third king of Israel, decides to share some of his wisdom with us. Now, even if you're not a follower of Jesus, most likely you've heard of Solomon. He's known throughout history for his great wisdom. Well, he ends up writing lots of different books onto ancient manuscripts. Some of those books became part of our Bible. One of those books is Ecclesiastes. Here's what Solomon writes in regards to our capabilities. He says this, using a dull axe requires great strength. So sharpen the blade. Using a dull axe requires great strength. So sharpen the blade. In other words, don't just go all the time. At some point, just stop, re-energize, refuel, renew yourself. So if you were at a conference on leadership right now, and they were talking about energy and staying strong and getting your schedule all put together, someone would stand in front of you and say, okay, what you got to do is figure out what energizes you. What are the things that just get you going and get you fired up? And then you've got to figure out what drains you. I think that's a great question. I actually asked myself that question in preparation for the talk. What energizes me? And I thought, learning new things energizes me. I like reading. I like watching documentaries. What a great thing to say when you're a pastor, huh? Ooh, it just sounds so good. Oh, you like to, yeah, I like to learn. Okay. I love that. It does something to me, as long as it's the right topics. If I'm going to learn about some engine, it doesn't do anything for me, right? But so there's things that energize me. Sitting around a fire with a group of guys just BSing. Just talking, having a good time with Cuban products. All right. So that energizes me. Doing activities with my wife energizes me. Oh, I'm sure activities with your wife. Yeah, just doing things with my wife energizes me. I'm going to Mexico with her next week. That kind of stuff just fuels me. Now, what drains me? I wrote these things down. And these aren't jokes. Managing people drains me. Meetings drain me. Emails drain me. At one point, a couple months ago, I was 150 emails behind in responding to people. Planning and organizing things drain me. Negativity drains me. You have to know in life what fuels you and what drains you. Great thing to think about. What fuels your wife or your husband and what drains them? You got to know that stuff. But now I'm going to just bring it a step further for us to think about. What energizes you and fuels you spiritually? You ever thought about that? Like, when do you feel closest to God? When do you feel energized? When do you say, God, my soul seems to be completely replenished. My energy about the things of God is just, there's excitement there. And what are the things that deplete you spiritually? What are the things that completely drain you spiritually? The reason you need to know this is if you're not careful, you're going to become so depleted spiritually that you're going to feel distant from God. You're going to feel like he's a million miles away. You're going to feel like he's uninterested in your life. You're going to hit a crisis and you're not going to have a strong foundation because you never discovered what it was. And so Solomon in another place in Ecclesiastes says this about how life is made. It says this, for everything, there is a season, a time for every activity under heaven. In other words, life has some sort of rhythm to it. There are seasons and days and years and cycles. Just the way God made life. In fact, he actually continues his thoughts in Ecclesiastes by saying there's a time to be born and a time to die. There's a time to work and there's a time to play. He says there is a time I'm just continuing to talk because I don't know what else he said there. There's a time to start things and a time to stop things. God didn't intend for you and I to live life at full throttle all the time. And yet, as Americans, we say, well, we know that life is short. We got to cram as much into it as possible. And what we see throughout the scriptures over and over and over, God says, when you build margin into your schedule is when you begin to experience the most out of it. It's when you begin to experience true life. When you don't have margin in your life, there's a few things that begin to happen, right? We know this is true. Our stress level increases. If you don't have margin in your schedule, every little bit of traffic irritates you. Every phone call from your spouse irritates you. Every distraction from a kid, I gotta get this done. Just irritate. You don't have margin in your budget. Every little purchase bothers you because there's no margin there. Yesterday, I flew out of Chicago O'Hare to come to Seattle. Typically, I fly out of Milwaukee. And so O'Hare's about an hour from my house, but I was there in rush hour. So I knew I needed to leave early. And I was so grateful to God that my wife was not with me. Because now I knew I could have time to leave early. All right, we weren't going to be pressing the clock. And so sure enough, halfway into my trip to Chicago, it's stop and go traffic. And I kept thinking, I'm so blessed that my wife is not with me on this trip. Because we would have left an hour later, 2 hours later. All right, we get to the airport, or I get to the airport because I drive by myself. I park in the farthest lot possible. Bus comes, picks me up, drives me to a tram. I have to wait for this tram forever, but I didn't care because I was by myself. I got there a couple hours early, hour and a half. I was enjoying it, right? And then I get to the kiosk to put my credit card in and get my ticket. And I said, no. I called my wife and I said, I don't even want to talk right now. I'm so glad I have Prozac in my system. I want to ask you this question. Did I leave my wallet at home? And she goes, yeah, it's right here. And I started dropping words that I learned from Pastor Ben. And I said, I can't do this. I don't know what's going to happen. And she had a friend coming from out of town that she was so excited. She said, she's going to be here any minute. She said, but I'm going to get in the van right now and drive it down to you. I've never been so happy. I just said, my wife's a blessing. My wife is a blessing. God, thank you. I'm so happy, my wife. I wish she was going with me on this trip. Oh, I wish. Literally, she gets to the airport. There's no time to spare. I didn't even kiss her because it was so quick. She handed me the wallet. I ran, and thank God for that TSA pre-check line. I said, I know it doesn't say pre-check. Can I please, please, please go through here? Yes, you can go through here. And so I made it. But let me tell you, the whole time, because of one little thing, my stress level is going up, and I thought I had it made. When you live life with margin, your stress level is fine. But if you don't have margin, it starts to increase, starts to go up. Another crazy thing about not living a life with margin is our awareness decreases. This is a spiritual thing here. You stop seeing the big picture. All you do is see what's right in front of you, and guess what happens? You start making emotional decisions because you're up against the clock, and you're just like, oh, this is all I can see, all I can see, all I can see is right here in front of me. In fact, I found a video that I think helps explain what I'm talking about. Check this out. Wow. Now these guys are on their bikes without any margin to this cliff on the side. They're surrounded by some of the most beautiful creation. Do they have time to just sit back and enjoy? Oh, look at that. Oh, look at that. No. They're just focused on what's right in front of them. Some of the biggest moral and ethical crises in our culture that have hit individuals came at a time where their life didn't have any margin. And they didn't have time to see the big picture. They didn't see, hey, this decision is going to impact me this way 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Most of us can look back at some of the most devastating decisions we made, and it was in a hurry and in a crisis, and I don't have time to really think about it. When we live without margin, our awareness decreases. Another thing that happens is our health is affected, right? Our blood pressure is going up. We get tired. We get sick. Our relationships start to suffer. Mom's always on the phone. Dad's always on the computer. Why are we always talking about money? Why do we have to do so much on vacation? We need a vacation from the vacation. And if you were to boil it down, I don't want to oversimplify it and pretend it's this simple, but really if you were to boil it down, it does come down to a pretty simple word called fear. Fear is what drives the cycle of chaos in our life. Fear. And the reason we know that is because if you just listen to the excuse you made, why do you work so hard? Well, I'm afraid that I'm not going to get noticed. I'm afraid I'm going to miss out on the promotion if they don't see me working like this. Why can't you say no? You know you don't have the time for it. I'm afraid they're going to think I don't like them if I say no. Why do you have to have our kids in so many different events? Well, I'm afraid they're going to miss out. I'm afraid my life isn't going to really matter. I'm afraid I'm going to fall behind. If you listen to people who live life without margin and they've crashed in their life, the story is always the same. At first, I was afraid. I was petrified. Kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. All right, here's the deal. We're stuck in this culture of fear. And God knows that. He knows the way we think. He knows the way we operate, which is why over and over and over in the scriptures, we're instructed, don't be afraid. 365 times, do not fear, do not be afraid. Like, there's one for every day of the year. One of those verses is found in Isaiah 41. Here's what it says. It says, don't be afraid, for I am with you. Don't be discouraged, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will hold you up with my victorious right hand. Whether you realize it or not, there is a direct correlation between what your life looks like and how much you trust God. Whether you realize it or not, there's a direct correlation between what your schedule looks like, what your budget looks like, what you're doing with your weekends, how you spend your mornings. There's a direct correlation between what that looks like and how much you trust God. And the reason we know that isn't just some sort of assumption, it's we look at the way God interacted with the people of Israel. Now, if you understand how the Bible is broken up, there's two parts, Old Testament and New Testament. Old Testament is primarily the history of Israel and how God dealt with the Israelites. For 400 years, Israel was in slavery. The Israelites were slaves in Egypt. They were told every day when to get up, when to go to bed. They were told what to do, how to do it. They were slaves. They, for all practical purposes, lived a life that other people told them to live. After 400 some years, they are led out of Egypt, and they are now their own nation, their own people. They're no longer in slavery. And God knows if I don't set up some rules and some boundaries and some guidelines, it's going to be anarchy. It's going to be chaos. It's going to be every man for himself. And so God stepped in and said, I'm going to establish some structures as a way of helping Israel renew their minds and helping them become their own society. And so he established over 600 rules and regulations for the Israelites to live by. That is a lot of rules. Not as many as your homeowners association, but still a lot of rules. And among those rules, he establishes three specific ones that have to do with margin. Actually, there's more than that, but three that I just want to quickly reference. We're not going to read any verses, but here's the ones God set up in the culture of Israel to get them to build margin. The one you're probably familiar with was called the Sabbath. God said each day, or each week, you have to take one day, it was a Saturday, that little you do nothing, completely, take it off. Why? So you build margin in your schedule as a way for them to remember God, to trust God. And he says, if you'll trust me, if you'll build this in your schedule, you will be able to do in 6 days what would normally take you 7 days to do. Just watch me bless you. Another law that he set up to build some margin in their schedule was the law of the tithe. He said, I want you to build margin in your budget. The tithe was literally you have to give back 10%. They actually ended up giving a lot more than that, but 10% of what you make back to the work of the Lord. It was his way of saying, I want you to trust me. I will bless the 90% in such a way that it'll be more than if you had the 100%. But you got to trust me. You got to take a step of faith. He wanted them to build margin into their budget. And then the third law was the law of gleaning. If you had a field, you couldn't touch the corners of the field. Usually you'd try to capitalize on everything and make every penny you could possibly make. God said, listen, you have to leave the corners of the field, and here's why. There's people in your society that are going to need some help. It was like a welfare system built into it. You need to leave that for other people. God says, don't just take everything for yourself and live life to the extreme. I want you to build margin into it. Your life. And the reason why God established that among the Israelites was this. He understood margin breaks the cycle of chaos in our life. He understood it. Margin breaks the cycle of chaos in our life. When life's too busy, when life's too crammed, when life's just jam-packed all the time, we start making dumb decisions. We start doing dumb things. Proverbs chapter 19, Solomon writes this, enthusiasm without knowledge is no good. Haste makes mistakes. Isn't that true? And the hurry of life and the rush of life is when we start doing some of the dumbest things. Some of you will remember this story. 1964, Jim Marshall, playing for the Minnesota Vikings, is in a game against the 49ers when the 49ers fumble. And in the craziness and the chaos of the game, he picks up the ball and he earns the name Wrong Way Jim because he starts moving in the other direction. If you've never seen the video footage of that, check this out. When the other team is patting you on the back, that's not a good thing. Now, here's the reality. That doesn't happen all the time in sports. On occasion, you'll hear some crazy story like that, but it happens every day in our life. Chaos of life, we get turned around, we're moving in the wrong direction, we don't even realize it. And we've talked about some of the serious consequences, but there's no greater consequence than what happens to us spiritually. When we get depleted, we start feeling distant from God. The needle of our souls is pointing empty, and here's what's happening. We're vulnerable. Our hearts become callous. The convictions that we used to hold so strongly to, they start to fade. The voices of fear and and chaos in our life start being a lot louder than the voices of trust and faith and stillness and peace. We become deaf to what God's trying to say to us. We become blind to where he's trying to lead us. And the tragic thing is, as our life's spinning out of control, we're saying, God, look at my life. How could you allow this? The tragic thing is when God feels a million miles away, we're saying, God, where are you? How could you desert me? Solomon continues his thoughts in in the book of Proverbs by writing this. He says, people ruin their lives by their own foolishness and then are angry at the Lord. He said, you're making your own decision to not still yourself, to be quiet, to be in a place where you can renew and refresh yourself spiritually, and then you get mad at the Lord when your life doesn't unfold the way you want it to. What does that mean? I mean, we know that having margin in our schedule means you have some breathing room at the end of the day. Having margin in our finances means, hey, we have a little bit of room at the end of the month, right? Moral margin means I stay away from the line so much so that I'm not going to put myself in a chaotic situation. Emotional margin means I've got some reserves when this crisis comes up. What does spiritual margin mean? It means that when I hit the valleys of life, I don't walk away from God, I run to him. It means that I've built my life on a foundation that I don't care what the crisis is, I'm going to stand strong because I found strength in who God is. And the interesting thing is, we'd all agree Jesus probably didn't need to do this, and yet he did this. He spent his time doing this. In fact, on one occasion, he spent an entire day feeding people, ministering to people, caring for people. And eventually, he sends them home, and his disciple Matthew tells us what happens next. It says this, after sending them home, he went up into the hills by himself to pray. Night fell while he was there alone. Later on, Matthew gives us insight into how Jesus responded when he heard that his cousin John had died. As soon as Jesus heard the news, he left in a boat to a remote area to be alone. From Mark's manuscript, we learn that Jesus had spent a day helping people emotionally and physically and spiritually. He was so exhausted, he went to sleep, gets up the next day, and before daybreak the next morning, Jesus got up and went out to an isolated place to pray. Luke, a well-educated doctor, talks about how Jesus used his time the night before he chose his disciples. Jesus went up on a mountain to pray, and then he prayed to God all night long. Later on, Luke tells us what happened when Jesus grew in his popularity, but Jesus often withdrew to the wilderness for prayer. Now think of how different that is from our culture. You grow in popularity, your business is growing, you've got things on your to-do list that continue to grow. What do? We keep saying, add more, do more, do more, do more. Oh, I'm exhausted. Here's some medication. Take it. It'll help you. We got to keep going more, more, more. Let's accomplish more, 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 more. None of that stuff's wrong. Jesus wouldn't condemn any of that. But what are you doing to refuel yourself spiritually? I've got five goals this year, five goals for 2014. One of the goals, in fact, it's the number one goal, I look at it every single day, is be astonished at the person of Jesus this year. That's an awkward goal, right? For a pastor, what do you mean, be astonished? Here's what I realized about myself. I've stopped being impressed with Jesus. Just have. I feel like I know how the Bible stories end. I'm not like, whoa, that was a surprise, right? I've memorized verses. I've been in church services day in and day out. I speak all that. I stopped being astonished, and I'm like, is it because Jesus isn't astonishing? I mean, that's how people responded to him in Scripture. It says they were astonished. Why am I not astonished anymore? My question, I guess I want you to think about as we wrap this up is, are you being astonished at the person of Jesus? Like, what has God been speaking to you this month? In the last year, are there any convictions that you've established in your life? Not because some pastor told you, just as you spend time with God, you're like, I think God wants me to add this to my life. Is there anything in your life that maybe legalism that he said, hey, you need to loosen your grip a little bit more? And just spending time with God did that. What has God been doing in your life? Maybe you've seen this on the news, this 500-year-old painting that recently has been in the news. It's called The Garden of Earthly Delights. A bunch of complexity, some nudity, which is why we got to keep it on the small screen. Just craziness. Well, apparently a college student for the first time in history has noticed on one of the pictures, it's actually on the guy's gluteus maximus, okay? On the guy's booty was some music. I'm not impressed by that. I've been making music with my booty for years. Well, it's just crazy. All these notes written. And so she actually is in the music, and she actually plays it and came to what it sounded like. Now, everything in me wants to play Sir Mix-a-Lot. I like big butts, and I cannot lie, but I would be asked to leave. And so I'm going to actually play you the real thing, the Gregorian chant here of what the music was on this guy's body. Check this out. Over 500 years it was in that painting. Nobody noticed it until a couple weeks ago. What have you noticed about God recently? I'll close with this verse. David writes this. He's king of Israel, second king. He says, I wait quietly before God, for my victory comes from him. You feel defeated in life? You feel defeated in your marriage? You feel defeated in your as an employee, as an employer? You feel defeated as a parent? You feel defeated as a child? How about waiting quietly before the Lord and saying, I'm going to find my victory in him? Now, that's going to look different for all of us based on personality. Maybe it's you getting alone with God in just a couple scriptures. Well, I don't know where to start. What are you dealing with? Anger? Google search versus on anger. I'm sorry, Bing search Google versus on anger versus on marriage. Maybe it's just saying, I'm going to pray. Get away. Find a time and a place. Get alone with God on a regular basis and refill your soul. I'm telling you, this is how we're going to stay strong in a world that constantly drains us spiritually and constantly would defeat us. And this isn't a boo culture thing. It's just the way life operates. So do we find our victory in the Lord?